Reviewville Sherlo, Sunday, November 25th, 2012, Israeli Society, the future relationship between the religious and secular sectors.
Welcome, everybody, to our lecture tonight on Israeli Society, the future relationship between religious and secular sectors. Our guest is Harav Yuval Sherlo, and I'll introduce him in a minute, but I first want to thank the people who generously sponsored tonight's talk, beginning with Nancy and Marvin Blyberg, who sponsored the talk in memory of Nancy's father, Dr. Edward J. Lackner, sorry, Yitzchak Ben Elazar Levi, Zatzal, Suri and Sheldon Chanlis on the yard site of Suri's father, Avram Yoshua Heschel Hauser, Ron and Pam Ennis, in memory of Pam's parents, Morris and Miriam Finson, Zichronam Levracha, the Lichtenberg family, to commemorate the third yard site of Barry's mom, Vera Walk Lichtenberg, Zichronam Levracha, Sharon and Naftali Rathenstorfer, in memory of Sharon's father, Walter Barth, Zichronam Levracha, and Cecile and Michael Wolman, in memory of Nicha Bat Yaakov Yehuda, Zichrona Levracha. Many of us go to Israel, and it's been said before that we very often live in an echo chamber. So if you visit your friends and relatives in Efrat, or in Alon Shvot, or in Chashmonaim, or in Baca, or Katamon, or for those of you who are more daring and in Ramot or in Bet Shemesh, you get a perspective on life in Israel. Every time I visit Israel, I visit those places and talk to those people, but I also get a chance to talk to my friends who are academics and live in Tzfon Tel Aviv. And it's blatantly evident that Israeli society, as polarized as it's always been, is becoming increasingly polarized, at least from my perspective. So we are actually delighted tonight to have someone who's part of a movement, someone who I've long admired, Rav Yuval Sherlo. Rav Sherlo is the Rosh Yeshiva of the Hesder Yeshiva in Petach Tikva. He's one of the founders of Tzohar, which is, as many of you know, an organization of rabbis in Israel whose aim it is to promote the understanding between the religious and secular communities. He is noted for his willingness to grapple with the really tough social and religious issues, ethical issues that Israel grapples with and Israeli society grapples with. He's a graduate of Yeshivat Har Etzion, a commander in Tzahal, and a member of the Ethics Committee in Misrad HaBriyut. He's also well known for answering questions, Sheilot, over the web. He has purportedly answered in excess of 30,000 Sheilot over the years. Some of those Tshuvot have been compiled in books. And he's also, of course, a well-noted Parshan. Rav Sherlo, you may or may not know, but tonight is the second time tonight that in Rinat Yisrael your words are being shared, because today, for those of us who were at Minchan Arvit, and there were about 150 folks at Minchan Arvit tonight, Bernie Stahl delivered some of your explanations on this week's Parsha and the Parshat of Dina and the whole episode of Dina and the brothers. So we've already enjoyed your words of Torah and are very much looking forward to your perspective on Israeli society. Let's fill up.
Shalom. Thank you for coming. Thank you for coming, because the idea that the relationship between Chilonim and Datim in Israel is bothering someone is something that is encouraging us to work and to do a lot of work in this, in those fields, because many times we feel that it's not an issue anymore and things are There are things that are more important, security or the economic situation or whatever, and the fact that all over the world this issue is important enough for people to leave their home and to come in the cold evening and to hear a lecture about it and to discuss this issue, I think it's very impressive and it's encouraging to continue to do a lot of work, even though things are really changing, I think, in Israel. And we should discuss if it's changing to a good direction, towards a good direction, or maybe to a worse direction. But let's start, first of all, with Parashat HaShavua. When we read Parashat Vayishlach and the next Parasha, we actually feel like the family of Yaakov Avinu is collapsing completely. Yaakov Avinu doesn't have any authority anymore to his children. Shimon and Levi do whatever they want. Reuven is conducting and trying to decide who will be Yaakov Avinu's first lady after Rachel Imenu died. The brothers are going with their sheep. He lives in Hebron and they go to Dotan. Dotan is near Afula. It's tough. You know, as far as they can, they go from their father. Yehuda is leaving the family and marrying a Bat Ish Knani, whatever the word Knani means, and is leaving his brothers. There is a lot of tension in the family, and the brothers hate Yosef Avinu, and he disappeared from Yaakov Avinu's point of view. So when you look about the family and you ask someone that doesn't know what will happen, what's going on, and what is the future of Yaakov Avinu's family, as I said before, it seems like it's collapsing, completely collapsing. And the reason is very, you know, everyone can figure out why. The reason is because for 22 generations, every father chose one son, appointed him as the continuation, and the other brothers disappeared. And the brother feels that it's going to be the same. Yaakov Avinu is selecting Yosef, and there will be like Ishmael, like Pilagshim, like Esav, whatsoever. And they decide to try to face it and to oppose it and to try to do things against it. And probably this is the reason that every one of them is trying to do something else and to be located and to be very strongly connected to his place and to a different family or any other solution except of being expelled like all the other generations from Eretz Israel and from the center of the world. In 4 weeks, in Parashat Vayichi, we'll read that the image that we thought that the family is collapsing is wrong. And actually Yaakov Avinu succeeds to unify from the beginning, to reunify the family, with a lot of help from Yehuda, from Reuven, from Yosef, everyone dedicated and everyone contributed his efforts. And in the end, we will read the final parasha that the family is, as I said, reunited. And I think it's a lot of to speak about a relationship between the team Chilonim in Israel in those weeks now. Yet we have the influence of the operation in the Gaza Strip is something that can show us that even though we are very disabused, and even though there's a lot of tension, and even though there are all kinds of disagreements and a lot of confrontations in Israel, we do see and we do believe that actually we are unified. And when there's an external danger, and when there's security danger, and when people are being recruited and are coming to the army or need to support the government or be able to be under a missiles attack, attacks, we see that actually things that we thought that will tear us completely and will not be able to do anything together, we do see that there things are different, and maybe it's time to analyze that the relationship between the Dattim and Chilonim is something different than we usually think. I want to try to describe my opinion and my way of looking about it. I'm not sure everybody will agree. I hope not. So therefore, we'll have a kind of a discussion, like a Beis Midrash. Maybe from different opinions, we'll analyze the situation correctly, and we'll find a way to change things, and to, as I said in the beginning, to work together in order not only to solve the problem, but to make a lot of benefits from the fact that there are all kinds of tribes in Israel, and all kinds of that Israel is very polarized, as you said in the beginning. Maybe it can be an advantage, not only a problem. Why do I think things are becoming different? Because actually, when we try to analyze the main confrontations that the Israeli society has, I think we can mention five of them. The first one is right and left about the settlements, about Yehuda Shomron. I mean right and left, not American terms, I mean Israeli terms. But actually, first of all, I'll count them, and then I'll say a few words about every one of them. The second one is Sfaradi Ashkenazi. It was a lot of tension. It is a little bit. And there is, we can count Sfaradi Ashkenazi. The third one is Arabs, Jews. I don't mean Palestinians. I mean Israeli Arabs and Jews. The fourth one is Datim B'chiloniim. And the fifth one is rich people and poor people in Israel. Now, if the elections, the coming elections, are a kind of an indicator that can help us to analyze where's the gap, where's the real discussion in Israel, actually, it will be very funny to say that 80% of the parties are saying the same thing. Actually, there's no real conversation in Israel. Let's go back to these five. First of all, about the territories, about Yehuda Shomron, what is the difference between Shelly Yechimovich, Yair Lapid, Bibi Netanyahu, and who knows, Tzipi Livni? What actually is the difference? Let's imagine, no, it's really science fiction, but if the Palestinians will come with, will agree that Israel will withdraw from Yehuda Shomron, will keep the big areas, you know, Gush Etzion, Ma'ale Edomim, and Ariel. They'll have a Palestinian independent state with all kinds of agreements. What percentage of Jews in Israel will agree to this agreement? I assume 80%, 90%. So where is the conversation? Let's go to the second thing, Sfaradi Ashkenazi. Who is really interested? Except Shas, that are really interested in this in order to support their importance, their unique party. But Shas is no doubt about it, that they'll get less votes. I don't know how much, but less than they had before. And actually, most of the parties are not interested anymore in those issues. It's a little bit important. So the Likud must have a few Sfaradim in there, and even the Mafdal, it's a problem, but it's not an issue today in Israel. So where's the conversation? Where's the gap? Between the Dattim v'Chiloniim, what's on the table? Is there a real discussion? And I'll come back to that, because this is our main issue. But actually, let's ask ourselves, what is the difference between the different parties? What are the suggestions? Are the religious parties suggesting that to make a chok tzitzit, that everybody should wear tzitzis according to the law? Are they trying to cancel or to avoid public transportation in Israel on Shabbat? More than that. So where is the real discussion? And the same thing between, the only gap that there is between Arabs and Jews, and that's really increasing, that's getting worse, but this is not the reason that we are discussing today. Why do I claim, and why do I feel, that the gap between the Tim and Chilonim is reducing? I think there are three reasons. The first thing is that actually there is a kind of atmosphere, environment, today in Israel, that chayev etan lichiyot, live and let anyone else to live in his way, and there is no real drafts that the team are trying to change, and there are drafts from the secular group, like trying to create a civil marriage and all kinds of conversions or whatever, but actually the majority of the parties are not going to change anything very important. I'll come back to it soon. But this is one thing. The second thing is that from both sides we have changes. The secular society in Israel is becoming more and more religious, but not observant, not orthodox. I want to explain this term. When we in Israel trying to translate the word dati into English, we say religious, but it's wrong. Dati is a observant. Dati is a orthodox. Religious is actually, when we say it in Hebrew, we say religiosi. You know, that's the only word we can find, yeah? And that means having very deep connection to God, to tradition, to all kinds of ceremonies, to heritage or whatever, to the family. And more people from the secular group in Israel, I think it's a part of the new age, part of, they don't feel that they need to make all kinds of ideologic attacks against religion, against everything else. They feel very comfortable, and you can see it. Many singers are singing all kinds of Jewish songs. Many artists are working on these terms. I think there are 4,000 groups of secular people that are learning Torah. 4,000 groups, different groups all over Israel that are learning in their way. They're not observing there. Sometimes when I participate there, or at least I hear, I don't know what to do with myself. It's not amazing. I don't know what term to use. But you can't deny the fact that they don't feel any problems to discuss and to learn. Especially they learn Chazal today, less Tanakh. Tanakh is not moral and not ethical according to their way of thinking. But Agada and is Beseder. So that's from one side. So from the secular group, people feel that they have personally and as individuals, they feel that they are much more familiar and much more comfortable to learn Yahadut without any problems. From the other hand, and also the Haredim are learning in the tough situation that the authorities that building big walls against what's happening all around is not succeeding. There is a new phenomenon in the situation, that is the internet. And then internet is actually dismissing all the walls, all the segregations, all the trying to isolate yourself. And the Haredim are discovering that their children are interested in other things, and are much open, and they discover that as bigger as their society is being, actually, again, the Knesset elections are a very good indicator that the numbers of Haredi Knesset members are not increasing, even though they have 8 or 10 or 12 children, and the secular people in Israel have 3 or 4 children. So why aren't the numbers increasing? And that's an indicator that they themselves are not able to keep their children anymore, and to keep their society as a closed society that will be devoted and will be will dedicate all their efforts in order to help and increase the influence of the Haredi society. That means that things are being opened more and more in the Haredi group, and much more knowledge. They go out to work. The academic degrees, the first degrees or second degrees, you can see many Haredim that are getting them. So things are being changed. So instead of having two separate groups, the groups are becoming more and more integrated. Still, we live in different places, but the fact that the location is less important. Because you know, I'm here, but once you are connected to your laptop, you are everywhere in the world, and the connection and things are happening without the importance of being located in a place, in a special place. So therefore, this is the second reason: the fact that the two groups are becoming less extreme, more combined. Walking towards the other group, I'm not many times, not because they want, but sometimes they are forced to do that, is changing the atmosphere in Israel. And the third thing is that everyone, I think, in Israel understands that there is a limitation and of power. I mean, you can't use a lot of power publicly. You can't force people to do things. And also from the philosophy point of view, I think that we feel that if the Knesset will force people to observe mitzvot or to do things that they actually against it or reject it, we are not sure that there is any religious value in it. I mean, let's say that there will be a law that will force everyone to wear tzitzis. And let's say, in Israel, a law is a recommendation. It's not something that you have to take too seriously. But let's say that people will keep it and the police will impose it. And let's say that everyone in Israel will wear tzitzis. What is the value of that? Because it's not because Hashem said it, it's because Bibi Netanyahu or whatever said it. So people understand that using power in order to achieve all kinds of religious achievements is something that we have to discuss from the beginning. So therefore, it seems like, as I said, that the tension between the groups is reducing. But the problem is, I'm not sure it's good news. I'm not sure it's good news, because it seems like, I'm very optimistic. I see that the situation is getting better, that the tension between individuals is much better. And you can see, and definitely, after those 2-3 weeks that we all together were under the danger and under missiles attacks and people really help here and there, and we felt unified. So why didn't I bring here L'chaim in order to celebrate that all the problems between the Din Chilonim were solved, and now we can make a big party and say, oh, it's in back of us, and we are over, we don't have it anymore. The problem is that I spoke about individuals. I spoke about people as private people making private decisions and understanding differently the situation. But when we are talking about the identification of the state, there we have maybe the reason that there is no tension is because that Israel is chas v'shalom losing the Jewish identification of the state as a group, not as individuals, not as making personal decisions, but what will be the Jewish identification of the Israeli state. Israel was established as a Jewish democratic state. Saying Jewish democratic state means trying to do something that is impossible, because we are talking about two sources of power, and there is a lot of difference between democracy and Judaism. I'm not talking about democracy regarding the idea that the majority makes the decisions. That's acharei rabim le'atot. That's all right with Yahadut, but the Western liberal democracy has been identified by the fact that there are things that the majority is not permitted to do towards the minority. That's the list of rights. And there is a big difference between the list of rights of Yahadut and the list of rights in the entire world. I don't want now to, you know, try to discuss that, but eventually we may reach a point where actually Israel will lose the Jewish identity of the state. What do I mean losing the Jewish identity? I'll mention three, I think, major things that I'm very concerned about them. The first one is a Jewish state must be the state of the Jews. Now, I'm not talking about the Arabs. Okay, so we have a minority of 20% approximately of Arabs. Okay, that's something that we'll have to live with it. It seems, never say never, but it seems that at least for the next 20 years, okay, let's speak about the next 20 years. But when we are talking about the 80% of Jews that we have, that are being considered as Jews, how many of them are not Jews? How many of them are not Jews? How many are making Aliyah from the former Soviet Union and from all kinds of other places? And when I'm talking that they're not Jews, I'm talking about two things. First thing is halachically. Halachically, I mean, there are who knows how many non-Jews or half-Jews, quarter-Jews, third-Jews, I don't know what term to use, that made Aliyah and that immigrated into Israel. They're part of the Israeli society, and there are thousands of them. But it's not only that they're not being Jewish halachically. When we are trying to ask what is their real identification, personally, we see that they don't identify themselves with the a Jewish tradition. They may identify themselves with the Israeli state, but not with the Jewish heritage. And that's one of the main factors that are pushing Israel from being a Jewish state to a civil state, with a kind of all kinds of symbols, but may cause this, and may, as I said, a very strong factor that is changing the fact that Israel is the state of Jews. Before asking about the law, about the constitution, about whatever. And that will cause things that people will not be able to marry each other. You'll have to check generations, for generations. There'll be all kinds of assimilations, of integrations, whatever, and nobody is solving this problem. Because I don't think I have to explain here that all the idea about conversion today in Israel is a big, big failure. I'll only mention one number, and that is, in Israel, actually there are, I think, 2,000 conversions are being made a year, but 4,000 children that need to be converted are being born every year. So make the calculation by yourself and understand the numbers by yourself. So the question, if what percentage of the state of Israel will be Jews by halacha, but not only that, will be Jews by their personal identification, the number and the percentage of them are being reducing. It's being reducing. And that's something that is really endangering the unification of the state of Israel, the reconnection between Israel and the entire Jewish world, and the identification, as I said, of the state of Israel. That's one thing. The second thing is that the idea about live and let other people do whatever they want may seem very, very liberal, very, very, it's a big progress, but you can, my approach towards it, it's the opposite. Actually, when I say, I'll do whatever I want without disturbing you, you'll do whatever you want without disturbing me, actually says that we are giving up. Even our confrontations, even our disagreements. You know, when you, let's say someone is getting married with a wife, and he says to her, you know what, I'll live my way, you'll live your way, and we'll not have any disagreements. Everybody will do whatever he wants. Is that something that has any value as a family? It's very easy to say that. It's very comfortable. It's you can solve many problems this way. But actually, you are not building something together. When I say that, you know what, as a secular, I don't mind, you know what, you want civil marriage, do whatever you want. Okay, I'll keep my way, you'll keep your way. Is that a progress? Or is that a withdrawal? From my point of view, it's not a progress. We are not doing something, we are not enhancing or promoting the Jewish identification as a society. We're actually giving up. And we are making the decision. It's much, much easier. It's not only the question of easier. Sometimes I really think, you know, it's a debate. I'm not thinking about the conflict. I'm talking about an internal debate. Because from one hand, I don't want to force anyone to get married in a different way he believes. And especially, I can't, as a state, avoid couples that the Rabbanut refuses to marry them because it's Kohen Vegrusha, because it's a Goyen Yudia, because whatever. Not to be married. The state, a modern state, cannot say that people will not be able to create families and to give the keys only to the Rabbanut. But from the other hand, saying that and trying to separate between the Rabbanut and the state means, again, that we're giving up. So we may be, it's maybe very, you know, friendly and very nice and without tension and without confrontation, and everyone will be able to do whatever he wants. But eventually what will happen is that this family will not exist as a family. It will be a kind of a corporation. It will be part of a company or whatever. But when we are speaking about this, you know, special Jewish state that is implying the vision of the prophets and building the pillars and creating establishing the pillars to the Mashiach state, whatever, we are going backwards. We're going to the in a different direction, and that's the second problem that I see in the current situation. You know, when I was an officer in the army, we had a special, when I became a major, we had a special training about when there's a bomb that, you know, there are 20 or 40 or 50 people that were injured, how to start? We are not doctors. We are, you know, we are. But what to do? Who will be first to get the treatment? And everybody, so the doctor asked us, and someone said, you know, the one that screams louder, I'll run to him first, you know. And the doctor said, that's wrong. The first one that you have to run to him is the one that is silent. Because if he's silent, maybe nothing happened to him. Okay. But usually, in most situation, when someone is silent, that means that his situation is the worst. It's so dangerous that he even is not able to yell. And I, you know, like a Hasidic story, I always claim that it's a very good principle that you can use everywhere. And once there are confrontation between the Tamim and Chiloni, that means that people are bothered by these issues and ideology and all those things. When it's silent, it can be a good sign. Okay, we solved and we made it's a kind of a reconciliation and all kinds of agreements. Okay, but I'm not sure. And what I'm saying tonight is that the fact that the tension between the Tayyim Chilonim is reducing is something that I'm a little bit worried, because I think that it's a result of the fact that we are not interested so much what will happen to our colleagues, our memberships, our friends, our family, our nation, and therefore we even stop fighting. And that's, I'm not so sure it's a good signal. Maybe it's the opposite. And the third thing I want to say, that I think that there's no doubts that the great thanks that we must give, I mean, the biggest contribution that someone did in order to keep the fire between the Tayyim Chiloniim very low and not as extreme, I think we should send flowers to the Arabs. Because when there's an external threat on the State of Israel, so the discussions for the last 40 or 50, 40 years of elections and the main discussions in Israel are still right wing and left wing about Yehuda v'Shomron, about all those issues. And even if someone thought in these elections the main issue will be the economics and the, you know, all kind of social justice or whatever, so the last 2 weeks actually changed the whole program, and we are again stuck with this issue as we were stuck for the last 40 years. So, and still, it's a very convenient for us. Once there'll be peace between Israel and the Arabs, I said it's science fiction, but let's say something like that will happen, then the tension between the Tayyim Chilonim may explode, because it's really, people are annoyed of the fact that the monopoly was giving to the chief rabbinate, and the chief rabbinate is not behaving as if it's a rabbinate to the entire state of Israel and to an entire nation of Israel. It behaves as if it's rabbanut for the datim, only for the datim, and the chief rabbinate is not solving the problems of marriage, of conversions, of shemitah, of, you know, all the big list. So nobody is interested in those issues, because we have worse things, or we have other things that are more important to deal with. But once those issues will reduce, if then maybe the atmosphere and the image that I think and I'm describing that the tension between the Tayin Chilunim is reducing, will re-explode, and then we'll be in a real problem because we'll not be ready in order to formulate from the beginning the relationship between the Tayin Chilunim. Let me summarize what I said until now. I'll continue for 5 minutes what do I think we should do, and then maybe we'll open a discussion. What I claim is the following. I claim that the tension between the Tayin Chilunim in Israel is reducing. And I think that only people that are making their... it's their job to light the fire, and they have good lectures in order to explain the tension. Chutz mehem, despite them, everyone, I think, will admit that the tension between the Tayin Chilunim is reducing. And actually, I think that, as I said, the elections are a kind of an indicator. For instance, the Lieberman, that his party was maybe the most effective and extreme party trying to change the constitution. Israel doesn't have a real constitution, but trying to change the law and creating civil marriage or whatever, actually they were swallowed by the Likud, so that's the end of that. So it also demonstrates the fact that it seems like things are reducing. And so therefore, as I said, we can celebrate it. I don't think that we should make our living from the tension between the Tayin Chilunim. But I'm concerned. And I'm concerned because of three reasons, as I said. And the fact that those three reasons are still there, I mean, the Jewish... First of all, the Jewry in Israel, how many... And what is the situation about assimilation, about a mixed marriage, about who's a Jew, as I said, halachically, and who's a Jew, even from his self-identification? That's a real danger. The second thing is the fact that there are issues that are not being solved and will not, they are still there. And okay, I don't have to repeat it again. What do I think we should do? As you know, when there's no tension, that's the real opportunity. There is an opportunity now. And usually we don't deal with questions that are not forcing us. Everyone knows that we deal with questions that are emergency and not importancy. Yeah, that's the, like everyone, and we have so many much issues that issues that are related and will be considered as an emergency, so nobody will deal now with the Tayin Chilunim. For instance, we are looking for candidates, or if someone is interested, even that there are going to be elections for the chief rabbinate. It had to be on May. It will be in June or July. Who's interested even? What's going to be? Who will be the chief rabbi in Israel? No one is really interested except the team. Yeah, except the groups of the team. But really, it's not an issue. So therefore, it's not an emergency. And therefore, nobody deals with that. My opinion is, okay, this is now the opportunity. Dafka, because there's a lot of tension. Dafka, because most of the parties say the same. So this is now the opportunity. Let's sit together and try trying to work together, not with the system who will pull the blanket to his towards his direction, but let's come and do the three things that we should do. First of all, let's elect a chief rabbinate that understands the situation, the dangerous processes that are taking place. We spoke about it before, that are brave enough and open enough to try to be inclusive rabbanut and not exclusive rabbanut, And that's one thing. The second thing, let's sit together with secular parties, with secular groups, and come to a kinds of agreements that will make the Jewish identity of the state of Israel stable and not part of politics, and will be again something that is created by agreement. And third, let's work with individuals and let's go from town to town, from village to village. Let's talk together, let's learn together, let's make keruv together, let's listen together, let's come to, you know, in Israel you define there's a very known part of the show, what is the Israeli dialogue. So they say in Israel that a monologue is when you talk to yourself, a dialogue when two people talk to themselves. Yeah. So let's start with Israeli dialogues and make a real thing, because everywhere when you don't use power, when you're not trying to force, when it's not a conflict, it's a dilemma, when you are trying to use a language that is a soft language and not a very powerful language, it makes things better. And I think if we'll do those three things, Chief Rabbinate, agreements in politics, and working together in the society, speaking with people and not only with groups or whatever, I think this is now the opportunity when the tension is reducing. If Chas v'Shalom will not do that, so maybe hopefully I'm wrong, and hopefully things will you be settled. But it's not nice to say that, but I think I'm not wrong. I mean, and I think that there is, you know, something. It's an underground. It can be an earthquake that actually will break the society in Israel, because when you deal with identifications issues, not with problems that you have to solve, but with identification, we see that they don't disappear. You think that you covered them, you think that they are not there anymore, you think that what's bothering people is only the reality and solving the current issues that are on the table, and identification doesn't bother them. And I think that everywhere in the world today, the European Union is learning in the bad way, that identification is something that is there, and if we will not do anything with that, and we'll try to cover the problem and thank the Arabs or thank the economic situation or whatever that is actually shifting our focus to other issues, one day it will appear again, and the earthquake will maybe something that will, you know, will destroy us. Because in the Jewish, and that's in Jewish history, we know that what caused the first destruction and of the Beit Mikdash and the second destruction of the Beit Mikdash weren't the external problems. Chazal are emphasizing the fact that the real thing that caused the destruction was the problems that were inside of the Israeli nation. And I believe that if this was the reason of destruction, or the sources of the destruction, it's also the sources of the redemption. And instead of being afraid that things will happen, I think that if we all will be recruited in order to solve and in order to promote the Jewish identity, trying to do that in an open market, in a new situation, without using power, using a different language and a different discourse, I think that the opportunities are now are on the table, and this is the time to do that, not to wait until there'll be an explosion, but As we say every Lel Shabbat, Sof Maaseh B'Machshava Tchila. Okay. I'm not sure I understood the questions. I'll answer, okay? And if I didn't give it a correct answer, so ask again, okay?
Could you repeat the question?
What is the ideal, I guess, community or revenue, or what is the ideal that we're working towards?
I'll explain what I understood is the question, okay? In order to make, you know, in Israel, when you find the word achdut, ichud, you know this is the place that people are fighting more than everywhere else. Everyone that knows geographic, en charot ichud ve'en charot meuchad, yeah, or ha'ichud ha'leumi, four different parties call themselves together ha'ichud ha'leumi, and they are completely torn out. And I can give many. Oh, Yahadut HaTorah Meuchedet. You know, the Haredim parties, they don't speak one to another Knesset member. And why is that? Because everyone supports Achdut. Everyone. But he has a tiny condition, and that is around me. Yeah? If everyone will think exactly like me, that means that I support the idea about Achdut. But Achdut, actually, in order to achieve Achdut, you must make concessions, compromises, agreement. It's like, you know, it's like, as I said before, like a couple that is getting married. Let's say that a couple will get married and they want to be very unified as a family, but they have a time, every one of them has a tiny condition that everything will be according to what he thinks. So try to create a family that way. So if I understood the question, is there other things that we, as the Zionist religious rabbis, are willing, are able to make concessions and compromises in order to include the entire society in Israel? If that's the question I understood, okay? My answer is yes. And I'll say why. Because the question is not making concessions about halacha or about my opinion or about the Gemara I'm going to study. This is not the issue. The issue is what will be the role of the state. For instance, if I'll agree that there will be a public transportation in Shabbos, it's not that as a rabbi I say that you are permitted to drive your car on Shabbos or to drive a bus on Shabbos, because I'll never say such a thing. But if I'll agree that there will be public transportation on Shabbos, it's because I'll say that I don't think it's the mission of the state to get involved in public transportation. So once you separate between those two issues, the first issue is halachically, what is your opinion halachically? Second, what is your vision about the role of the state in order to impose Yahadut? And it's two different questions. Then I think we can come to many, many agreements. That's one thing. And I think we did it. As I know, the state is not forcing people to keep kilayim or to keep tzitzis or to keep I don't know whatever to from tariag mitzvot. The state is not. So the question is, what should the state get involved in? My personal opinion, first of all, is that the state should not get involved at all in individual religious life. And I'm against, like, for instance, Chok HaChametz. The fact that the state is getting involved in chametz is a wrong thing, according to my opinion. Okay, the only two things that the state should deal is, first of all, the public environment. Yeah, what will be the public identity of the state of Israel, the Jewish public identity of the state of Israel? That's one thing. And the second thing is to find a solution. And I don't. There are all kinds of suggestions. But to find a solution to the marriage issue, okay? That the state will be responsible that the Jewish nation will exist. Yeah, and that's a very, very important thing. But as I said before and mentioned before, I learned it from my Mori v'Rabbi Rav Amital Zecher Tzadik Livracha, that we should understand, we must understand, that the state must have also a solution to people that we disagree to marry. Yeah, and something should be done as a state, and there are all kinds of suggestions. So that's one answer. The second answer, now I'm speaking as a rabbi, not as someone, as a rabbi, I think that for the issue of conversion and of including many of the, not all of them, many of the immigrants that came from the former Soviet Union, we must do two things. The first thing is to understand that it's not only an individual question, let's say that someone is coming to convert, it's not only his question. I mean, today is Sh'at Cherum, it's Sh'at Adchak, and we have to go to the most Shitot Mekilot in order to make the conversions. That's one thing. The second thing is what Tzor is doing today. We discovered that actually there are between 15 and 20% of the people that came from Russia, that they think they are not Jews, but they are Jews. But they have very, very, it's very difficult to prove it. And now it's the last time, because you can prove it through their grandmothers, but the grandmothers are, you know, after it's Ma'asrim Shana, they're dying. So we have now a window, and that's what we are doing now. Tzor, because Tzor decided, if we'll solve 15 or 20% of the problem, we'll, you know, it will be very nice. Okay, because, you know, usually you want to solve the whole problem, but let's start with 15%. And so if there, as a rabbi, we'll do two things. One is to try to make an inclusive conversion according to halacha. I'm not talking about all kinds of, you know, things that are not according to halacha. And from the second thing is to help people to prove their the fact that they are Jews, so we will solve a big part of the problem, not the whole problem, but let's start with that. Okay?
Can you describe the process for selecting the next sheikh for us?
Oh, yeah. Okay, now, in Israel, okay, it's a very interesting thing. I'll explain it. Who elects the rabbi? It's unbelievable. I hope you'll believe me, because I'm going to say what's the law in Israel, but I'm not sure you'll believe that this is the law. Okay? So there is a group of 150 people that are electing the chief rabbi. Okay? Who are the 150 people? They are people that are there by law. I mean, the 10 mayors of the big towns in Israel. Okay? The 10 rabbis of the big towns, biggest towns in Israel and region towns and whatever. The Knesset is sending, I think, 6 Knesset members, part of the coalition, part of the opposition. 2 ministers, the chief rabbis, all kinds of, you know, that's the body that is electing the rabbis. The problem is two things. One is that I think more than half, I think maybe more than two-thirds maybe three quarters of this body are not really interested. Who will be the chief rabbi? It's politics. And as a mayor of Herzliya, okay, if the interior minister will tell me, if this rabbi will be elected, you'll get, your budget of the town will be bigger. So, well, who do I care? Also from the Haredi side, what do they care who will be the chief rabbi? The only thing that is important, that it will not be a Zionist religious one. Okay, that's the most important thing. So that's one thing. And actually, it's really something so that's one problem. The chief rabbi has been elected, or maybe this is the problem. He's been elected by a group of people that most of them, I think three quarters of them, are not really interested who will be the chief rabbi. And it's not only that they are not interested, it's the fact that it will not have any influence on them, on their lives, or on their parties, or whatever. Nothing. Because the only group in Israel that actually is listening, is trying to listen, I think even we stopped, is the Zionist religious movement. And it's really a pity. Because from the other hand, as I said before, if the chief rabbinate will function in the way that I don't say that I think they should function. If the chief rabbinate will function in the way they think it should function, without fear, without politics, without so it has a lot of power in its hands, and it's really a pity that this is the way that the chief rabbinate has been elected. We are now, you know the situation in Israel without any, what I'm going to say is not news. The Sephardic rabbi, the next Sephardic rabbi will be elected by Shas. Okay, it doesn't matter who and what, probably will be elected, unless something really will happen in the next coalition, and Shas will not be part of the coalition, I think. You can't think about it, this situation, but probably you will be elected. Actually, Shas are dreaming that Rav Amar will continue, but according to the law, he can't. After two terms, he can't. But you know, you can change the law. It's not a problem. It's not a problem in Israel. They tried to change the law, and now they didn't succeed. But who knows, you know, it can be part of the coalition. As I said, a law in Israel is something very, very smooth. You know, it's not something that that you have to take it too seriously. The Ashkenazi rabbi, it's a big question. It's a big question. The question is the following. Is the Zionist... I think the following. If the Zionist religious movement will be able to... stand behind one candidate and not be separated into different candidates, there is a chance, with God help and whatever, is that there'll be a Zionist religious rabbi will be elected. But even in the Zionist religious movement by itself, there are two kinds of candidates. And that is, one is the candidate that will be the best chief rabbi to the religious people. He's a great Talmid Chacham, and he's a great Dayan and whatever. And part of us think that the most important thing of a chief rabbi, is that he's able to be a rabbi to Klal Yisrael. So it's a different... So first of all, we should decide who do we want to send. And then he may be elected. He may be, but hopefully. Mm-hmm.
We've been to Rome several times, and I've been intrigued by the model in the Greek synagogue of Rome, where there's one Judaism, one religion, and it's orthodoxy, and that's the rule of the show. But at the same time, most of the converts, many of the converts, are not Dati, they're not observant, and I think. You know, the price that you pay, if it's a price, is that there's much greater tolerance for the people who are not Dati. So people come to Shalom Shabbat, they're carrying a newspaper, they have a cell phone on the belt. And from several years ago, one person made a huge impression on me. He came in shortly before Hafnasa Sefer Torah. They brought out the Torah. He said Shema Yisrael, you know, with a lot of kavana. He blew kisses to the Sefer Torah, stayed for the first Aliyah, and he left. And you see, here's someone who was welcomed to the shul, who felt it was important to him, whatever he was doing on a Saturday morning, whatever he's going to store. You know, he made it his business to come to shul on Shabbat for 15 minutes and say Shema Yisrael and blow kisses to the Torah. And you know, talking to people I know in Israel who are not Dati, so first of all, of course, they're very upset about the situation in the army and the Haredim not contributing to society, not contributing to the army. They're upset that they're coerced, but they're also upset that there's really no outlet. It's either you're Dati or it's all or nothing. And you know, to me, it's very intriguing. And you know, if someone came in like that, and even in this show, you know, I don't know how people would react. But to me, there needs to be some outlet for people who are, you know, have an aspiration to be traditional, but to give them credit for whatever they do and have an opportunity for them to do whatever they do and be looked up upon and be encouraged as opposed to discouraged, even if they're still not Shomer Shabbat or they still have the cell phone on their belt.
Okay. I have two responses. First of all, I completely agree with you. Now, the Ashkenazi shuls in Israel didn't succeed to invite secular people or even Masorti people into their shuls. I don't know why. I don't know what. I'm not sure I'm able to analyze why. But you said it. You said it. And the fact that I know when I was a rabbi in my shul in Petah Tikva, people didn't like that the secular bar mitzvahs are coming on Shabbos because they are trying to photograph and because of cell phones and because of here and because of that and because of that. And slowly, the secular Ashkenazi people felt uncomfortable in our shuls and they left. And they left. I remember as a kid, they usually came on Simchat Torah, they came for Ne'ilah, they came for Yizkor, they came for that. Today, nothing. What we didn't, and that proves that what you said is correct. Now, the second response that I have, in Tzohar, we discovered it. And what we did on Yom Kippur is to try to do something different. And we opened minyanim for secular and religious people, but not in shuls. And you know, matnas everywhere, but not in shuls. Okay. And this year we had 220,000 people in those minyanim. Okay. So that's the thing. That's the thing. But I really want to make the shul's much more friendly and much more inviting and much more inclusive. I don't know how. And the reason I don't know how is because of two reasons. There are the two reasons. First one is that, you know, people feel, I mean, the congregation feels that their shul, they don't want to be disturbed, they don't want to hear cell phones, they don't want that people will come here and there. I can understand them, but you have to recruit people to do this. That's one thing. The second reason is because I didn't speak about that, but there is also a process in our society that we are becoming more I want to say something good that will sound bad, or I mean, we're becoming more the team. Okay. So it's good. That's what I'm doing as a rabbi. First of all, myself, I want to be more Dati but actually, we are isolating ourselves from the entire society. Okay, for instance, you heard about it. So again, you're so involved in what's happening in Israel about what happened in the army of the voice of girls that are singing, and suddenly One day we decided that we can't be part of ceremonies in the army where a singer, a female, sings a hatikva, chas v'shalom. So that's, you can look on it as if, oh, thank God our children are more dati. But I'm not sure it's more dati, but let's say it is more dati. The price that we are paying is isolating ourselves. And then we are not relevant. We are not relevant because if we are not taking part in those ceremonies, so we are also not invited. And we are not inviting other people to us, because they ask us, well, what will be the status of women? Okay, so we have to decide what exactly do we want. That's also part of the answer to your question. Excuse me, what's your name? Ayelet's a question. It's also part of it. I must my personal experience. Here you have it, but I had it this Shabbos the first time. I have a daughter in Cornell. I'm coming now from Ithaca. I was in Shabbos in Cornell. My daughter is with my three grandchildren, and she's writing her postdoc in electronic engineering, not something that I understand the word. And okay, and because of Thanksgiving, we had to grab a minion, you know, to collect a minion. We didn't have a minion for Leil Shabbat, but we had a minion for Shachris, okay? And because I'm saying Kaddish, my mother passed away a few weeks ago, Zichrona Livracha. So in the first time in my life, I said Kaddish with a woman. You know, she was a single woman in Ezrat Nashim, and I had this experience, and I knew about it. I wrote about it, but I didn't say Kaddish, and I didn't. You don't have it in our society, and everybody heard her and me, because we were only 11 men and one single woman in the Ezrat Nashim. And again, we have to decide what do we want, because if we want to be inclusive. You can't be inclusive when you are not really open, and when you are not inviting, and people will feel not comfortable, and it will be inconvenient to be in your society. So we have to make the decisions. So in future, and I want to be very clear, there are things that I will not do, even though they'll be exclusive, because this is the halacha, but we have at least to include in our halachic conversations the question about Klal Yisrael. We have to include it. And if not, you know what? When everybody knows it, he knows it not when it's a discussion about someone else, it's about his child. When someone has a child that, let's say a rabbi was asked, can you invite secular people for Shabbos meal, even though they'll drive? Okay? So many rabbis will answer, if you'll invite him for Leil Shabbat, and he'll decide not to stay, it's alright. But to invite him for Shabbos meal, in the noon that you are part of the invitation is that he'll drive on Shabbos, okay, that's an answer I gave too. I'm still giving it. But when a rabbi has a secular child that says, Abba, can I come for Shabbos meal on Shabbos? And he says, what? No to his child that wants to come for Shabbos? Then, you know, then things are being opened. Again, and we have to discuss. I didn't say that that's a reason. I didn't say, I think, I want to emphasize, I didn't say that the fact the rabbi feels not convenient with his child is a reason to change the halacha. It's a reason to rethink. Rethink, okay? Maybe the answer will be yes. Will it be no? I can't. Please come only for Leil Shabbat if you are driving on Shabbat. Maybe. But we have to rethink about what we are considering as a progress in our Dati movement. Because as more as we are better in keeping halacha, and I'm saying again, that's what I want to do personally, we are isolating other people. And we have to make the decisions. Okay, last question, because I'm here, okay, but yeah.
Yes. If the next chief rabbi is not from amongst Rabbanei Tzvi, and the next chief rabbi is Haredi. Can that work for the Dati Lumi community? And if it cannot work for the Dati Lumi community, what kind of alternative rabbinic authoritative structure can you set up?
I don't know. I don't know to answer. I think the word will be ceasefire. I mean, you know, I'm saying the following. It's not only the question of Haredi or Zionist religious. It's the question what will be his policy. I mean, I'm trying personally not to divide the world, you know, to the good guys are Tzioni Dati and the bad guys are everyone else. Depends. Let's say one of the candidates, for instance, is the Rav Dudi Lau, David Lau, from Modi'in. Okay, he's socially he's part of the Haredi group and he's been supported by them. But you can't say that Rav Lau is Haredi, and he's a good friend of mine too, and he's a very talented rabbi. And he has very good relationship with the Chiloni. I mean, we'll see if he'll do good things. If he'll be elected, I mean, and he'll do good things, and he will see himself as a rabbi to Klal Israel. So let him be Haredi. I mean, I don't want to. You know, that's why I'm talking personally. But if Chas v'Shalom, he will not do anything. Oh, he'll do things that will increase the separation between groups in Israel, and probably what will happen without a lot of meaning and without a lot of work, the status of the chief rabbinate will continue to decrease, and a lot of things in Israel, Tzohar as an NGO or someone else, as the real Rabbanut will be kind of an NGO, and maybe it's better. Maybe it's. I think it's not. I think the best thing for the state of Israel is that the chief Rabbanut will identify themselves as Zionist, as responsible to Klal Israel, not only in the state of Israel but also to the entire Jewish nation in the world. And again, I'll accomplish with a story from Ithaca. I went to this morning to buy something in a store in Target there in Ithaca, and a 70 years old woman, approximately, came to me and said, Yamike. What? Okay. To make a long story short, she said later on, I think I'm Jewish. I'm thinking, serious. My mother was Jewish and my grandmother was Jewish. So, and I was in her grave of my mother's, and I saw, and she didn't know the word. So I asked her, Magen David? No. And she didn't know the word Hebrew letters. She didn't know to say Hebrew, she didn't know the word Hebrew. Okay? The only thing that she knew about her Jewishness was Yarmulke. That's the only thing. She recognized me as a rabbi, and she knew Yarmulke. And I see her in front of my eyes, and I see that, you know, 20% of the students in Cornell are Jewish. Approximately 20%. But they don't identify themselves as Jews. And I don't know how many of the staff, you know, in Cornell, and other places. These are the people we have to think about. And we are. I'm telling my colleagues constantly that we are dealing with every inch of Eretz Israel. We have to try to connect, to reconnect every Yehudi in the world, and we are losing them. And instead of that, we're, you know, doing all kinds of things. So maybe I hope that the chief rabbinate will do the right things. If not, so we'll work as NGOs.
I'm not going to write it, but okay. Yeah, I'm sorry.